had a list of what those are. The Dash 2 amendments worked out since that hearing do reduce the filing fee to $20 for all nonprofit business registrations. So their original registration and their renewals will be $20. So that's what they were before last session. It does maintain the higher level fee of $50 for initial filings for registration of other business entities, for trademark registrations, and for assumed business names, again, for for-profit businesses. But the amendments do reduce the annual reports, which are subsequent to the initial filing, and any renewals of registrations to $20. And finally, the amendments provide that nonprofit historic cemeteries may file business registry documents for free. So again, the only thing that remains at $50 is the initial filing for for-profit business transactions. And the nonprofit's original initial fee and renewal fees will be $20. And the historic cemeteries will be zero. At your place today was a spreadsheet prepared by the Secretary of State's office that shows the amount of money coming in under the current amounts and the amount that would be reduced to the general fund. This bill does have a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee, Mr. Chair. And although we don't have an impact from the Legislative Revenue Office, their initial impact for the original bill was higher than the Secretary of State's estimate. So there may be some change in the general fund impact from the Legislative Revenue Office's estimate of the amendments as well. And we don't have that this morning. Thank you.
Thank you, Janet. And this will remove the this Pioneer Cemeteries, the Dash 2 as well.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, that language about the nonprofit historic cemeteries starts on line 17 of the Dash 2 amendment. Okay. The representative from the Secretary of State's office here, if you have any questions about any individual
report. Representative Nelson, did you want to comment on the amendments?
Chair Brown and members of the committee, I want to, I'm Donna Nelson, State Representative District 24, and I want to thank you on behalf of the 330,000 businesses, small businesses we have in the state, and also for the nonprofits. And as many of you are aware, many of those small businesses are almost nonprofit. So every nickel matters when we are building businesses and growing and providing employment for others. This is the right thing to do. I really appreciate the Secretary of State's office saying this increase was unnecessary. It was refreshing to me because most agencies are in demanding additional money. And this was one that honestly came forth and said this was a non-essential increase. And I just want to thank the good Secretary of State, Bradbury, for having the integrity to come forth and let us know that this was unnecessary, should not be penalized in our small businesses who indeed are the engine that make this state run. So I appreciate this amendment. I know those with the Pioneer Cemeteries will appreciate it too, not having to pay a fee that is non-essential. So on behalf of all of our small businesses and Secretary of State who did come forth, I want to thank you very much for this effort. I appreciate all of you.
Thank you, Representative. Have you, that was the Dash 2. Have you seen the Dash 1s?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Representative Kitts, could you, the Dash 1 amendments, Spears, you mind going through them with us a little bit here?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I have no problem with that. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Nelson, for your words. I think they are very accurate. Basically, what the Dash 1s do is they combine the two problems as I see it. It leaves the initial filing fee at $50 for businesses with the annual report to be lowered to $20, and then exempts the Pioneer cemeteries out of the annual report, but also at the same time lowers the fee for the articles of incorporation to $20 from the $50. Are you clear as mud now?
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Janet?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't believe the Dash 1 makes any changes to the nonprofit. And that was something that we had talked to you, Representative Kitts, about later and did incorporate in the Dash 2s.
And so the difference between the Dash 1s and Dash 2s is...
Mr. Chair, while we're figuring that out, I'd like to ask a couple questions
for
a good representative. Representative, I've joined you this session in voting for a whole lot of stuff that's going to incent, attract, and retain investment in the state, from land use to the revenue system, to all kinds of stuff. And I think there's 90 legislators that got elected in this state that all come down here saying we're going to fund education and health care and safety. The revenue impact, negative impact by doing the Dash 2s, I believe, if I got this squared away, and I'm not saying I do, is $8 million. I'm concerned, and I know you share my concern. And I also come from a home of two small businesses. My wife employs six people. So I definitely understand that, very much so. How are we going to do all this? I want you to help me here.
thank you for this opportunity, Chair Brown and Representative Schaffler. First, I want to thank you and your wife for these two small businesses that do employ six people.
May I clarify, my wife employs six people.
Your wife employs six people, and I am most grateful for that. And I hope someday it's 600, because we have a huge number of individuals who are unemployed. I think your vote for this bill is a vote for employment. So, number one, if you want to know where your money's going to come from, it's going to come from employed individuals. If you take Speaker Menace's education bill, for example, that dedicates, you know, that income tax, personal income tax, to education every year, this will help. These small businesses need to grow, and those individuals will produce more income tax. Further, I'd like to tell you that if you'll vote for my House Joint Resolution that ends unfunded mandates on schools, you'll find that we would have some $500 million more for schools, as those unfunded mandates take up 8 to 10% of that $5 billion budget. So that's one good way. Also, we need to prioritize public safety, which is our top priority, and I believe the governor has already taken care of that designated source.
Well, I know we're not hearing this, but we're going there. Would that include the president's No Child Left Behind unfunded mandate?
Well, unfortunately, Chair Brown and Representative Schaffler, we haven't got to Washington yet, but as soon as this session's over, we'll be there.
Well, if you get rid of that, I'll send you there myself.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Kitts, do you have a preference on the
I'm trying to look at them side by side here and decide which one has the better chance of passing through this committee, to be quite honest with you, Mr. Chairman.
Does he need some help, Chair Brown?
Heck, Don, I can't even find a wife, much less to distinguish.
I'm still working on that issue. You never fear. Have faith.
Mr. Schmidt, does the chairman have a preference of either of the... I believe the my understanding from talking to Janet, Mr. Chair, is the dash twos are reflective of the conversation that you and I had.
Chair Brown and Representative Kitts, I might also say they also meet the results you wanted when you talked to me about this bill.
Jen, is that your...
The dash twos.
The dash twos would take the renewal and the annual report down to $20 from $50, leaving at $50 the initial articles of incorporation.
Right. For for-profit.
For for-profit. Okay. And then exempting... with the exempting of the Pioneer Cemeteries for the renewal, but at the same time reducing their initial articles from 50 down to 20 where they were.
Mr. Chair, that's correct, except for the nonprofit historic cemeteries will not have even an initial filing of $20.
Better yet. And Mr. Chair, I would support the dash twos over the dash ones.
Thank you, Representative, for your testimony. Representative Kitts moves the dash twos to House Bill 2603. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, the dash twos are adopted then. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I'd move House Bill 2603 as amended to the... Is it to the floor?
Ways and Means.
To the Committee on Ways and Means with an adamant due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 2603 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion, Representative Shields?
Yeah, just for clarification, Janet, the fiscal impact of about $8 million will still be there with the dash two amendments.
Go ahead, Janet.
Mr. Chair, again, this is the estimate we have from the Secretary of State's office about the current level of business, not projecting out of any future increase in business that might happen over the next biennium. So this is for next biennium. Their estimate, and as I said, when we got the Legislative Revenues Office estimate for the effect of the original bill, it was higher than the Secretary of State's office, so it could be a bigger difference when we get that revenue impact. But this is the estimate given current business.
It's pretty close.
Representative Shoffman.
Thank you. You know, with the young gentleman from Secretary of State office said just passed out of the last session by 3/5 vote out of a what I would call a conservative house. Now, I'll be voting yes on this, but 2 years from now, I'm going to want to see some jobs materialize. And that's what I'm going to want to see, and I don't get what I want. I barely ever get what I want. You know, I just want to put on the record that I'm concerned about where we're going to get the money to pay for medicating, educating, and incarcerating folks here in the state of Oregon. So we better get some jobs going out there, and this better pay off. For 2 years from now, I'm going to sit here and bellyache about how it didn't happen. That's what I want to see, and it's what I want. I don't know if I'll get what I want, but I just want to share my concern about all this with all you good people.
Representative Kitts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would revert back to my previous comments to Representative Nelson and not being married, so I think I can comfortably say that I do from time to time get what I want. That being said, I think that this has been a bill that, quite frankly, is a good business bill, and probably never will be married now, huh? Mr. Chair, this is a good bill. Business licensing fees for this state have no business being in the general fund, to be quite candid from my opinion. They're for business fees to license themselves with the state to be an active and productive part of this state. And if Representative Schaffler wants to refute what I say, I will be speaking after him as well. I would say that this is a good use of taxpayers' dollars. This is a necessary use of taxpayers' dollars. And we need to help these businesses survive any way we can, Mr. Chair, and in producing more jobs, more revenue, more income for the state, to increase the general fund in legitimate ways and not artificial ways. So it is with a gleeful yes that I will be supporting small business with an aye vote here today in this committee on this particular bill.
Representative Holden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will be voting no on this bill, as my wife also operates a small business. But I do see our budget is really putting a lot of pain in our education system and our healthcare system. And these $1 million, I think, really help out there. And as I see a shift of tax burden being shifted to wage earners, I think this will increase the amount of taxes wage earners pay. And I will be voting no on it on that basis. Thank you.
Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I do appreciate the hard work of the good representatives from McMinnville and Hillsborough on this bill, particularly in limiting the scope of nonprofits for whom the fee would be waived. But in my district, we're closing three schools. We're laying off two kindergarten teachers at Irvington Elementary and stripping down the talented and gifted program at Saban Elementary. And I believe that most businesses, or particularly the businesses in my district, would rather have the $50 fee stay the same and have the schools receive $8 million. I believe that's good for business, and I'm not convinced that by a $30 savings will create any jobs, and because of that, I'll probably be voting no.
Representative Schaffler.
One more, Mr. Chair, and then we'll move on. But, you know, I really wish we had kept this in the Secretary of State's office rather than going to general fund. I don't know how many dollars we get back due to auditing, but if we could have hired more auditors, we'd be getting more money back, and it would have paid for itself. And at the same time, due to the cut in general funds, we've been cutting all kinds of stuff. Or I don't know if exactly comes from the general fund or not, but I believe it does. The cutting of the Bureau of Labor Industry Director's office, we've cut it in half over the last several years. We don't even know if employers are paying the right amount of money. We don't know if they're paying the right wages, they're withdrawing the right taxes, they're paying their workman's compensation, unemployment insurance. There's a lot of things we can do that's legitimate in state government to make not only this state healthy place to invest your money, but also to raise enough revenue to, and once again, educate, medicate, and incarcerate, something 90 legislators and a governor ran on. That's all I got to say. If the good representative from North Plains wants to say something about that, I'm all ears.
Any other comments?
Can we vote on this?
And we're ready. We're just about ready to, Representative. You know, these fee increases that were passed through in the last session was done when our revenues were down over $1 billion from where we're at now. And that's $1 billion to me is a pretty sizable chunk of money. And the desperation that went on in this building and through five special sessions and through the last session in trying to balance the budget, we were literally looking everywhere in every corner to try to find some fees or increases to find some money. And we did. And on that time's passed, our revenues are up over $1 billion. And so I think now it's time to take a look at where some of these came from. And this is one step in that way. And with that, Katie, we're ready to vote. Call the roll.
Representative
Kasparov. Aye.
Representative
Kelly. Aye.
Representative
Colby.
No.
Representative
Kitt.
Aye.
Representative
Schaffler.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
No.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carries. Boy, I hope the rest of them don't take that long.
Both of them.
Amendments and
which one have to do with that?
Problem once you start putting those fees on.
Representative Nelson, are you here to testify on 3344?
Why don't you put those fees on?
Okay. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3344. Which one? 3344. Right. 33. That's what I said. 3344. I don't have a sheet on it. Can you give us a summary?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, Senator George.
House Bill 3344 would disallow banks from agreeing to vary provisions by law. Provisions of law by agreement relating to bank deposits and collections. It deletes a provision that a warranty can be disclaimed if notice of the claim for breach of warranty is not given to the warrantor within 30 days after a claimant has reason to know of the breach, and requires banks to provide a free second copy of a statement of account within 24 hours of the customer's request. And limits the conditions under which a bank customer is precluded from asserting against a bank that a payment was unauthorized. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet.
Sean, thanks.
Could I have Representative Nelson and Eugene Schoenheit, please?
Major.
Oh, I didn't see that.
It is 33.
Yeah, 3344. Yeah. Good morning again, Representative.
Thank you, Chair Brown and committee members. I'm Donna Nelson, State Representative from District 24. This is a very serious issue today, House Bill 3344. This last year, and far before I was named chairman of the Committee on Veterans Affairs, my phone began ringing off the hook. Many people calling to say, State Representative, we need your help. One of our most decorated and beloved colonels was being evicted from his home because of a fraudulent action taken by his bookkeeper and also by the bank, Washington Mutual, which handled his account. For an individual who was shot down 4 times in 3 wars on our behalf, who's now a senior citizen, for his wife and he to be evicted from their home at gunpoint by the Washington County Sheriff's because their money had disappeared from Washington Mutual Bank. This is the most disgraceful, disrespectful, unappreciative act that I think any financial institution could bestow upon an individual who risked his life so many times for us and for our freedom. Using the few personal skills I have, but with the help of the veterans across the state, we conducted barbecues and auctions. And I received calls from as far away as New Jersey from veterans who said, this man is beloved and respected and has done so much for America. Why would he be evicted from his home because of a fraudulent act? Well, unfortunately, the bank prevailed because they utilized UCC rules instead of state statutes, which would have given these people, the Ricers, an opportunity to to keep their home in the last days, last years, many years, I hope, of their lives. I hope this bill passes. It's time that our financial institutions were required to abide by state statutes. I appreciate this bill being brought, and I would just like at this time, if it's okay, Mr. Chair, to ask for recognition of Colonel Reister and his wife who are in this room today. Thank you.
Eugene?
Well, I'm the one who wrote this bill, and I handed to you a statement or a summary of this bill. We call it the Ken Reister Consumer Protection Act, and I just have to say, I hope you read it. It's better than anything I could say here. I wrote it.
Eugene, can I get you to say your name for the record?
Eugene Schoenheit.
Thank you.
And my name's on stuff all over the place here. What we face in Oregon is a check problem. And then, you know, here's an example of a check, you know, that say could be fraudulent. I mean, what it amounts to is anybody can write a bad check. Or I should say, any criminal can write a bad check. Anybody who's trying to take them can try to take somebody can write a bad check. And what they do is they turn the check into the bank, into a bank for processing. The bank doesn't look at it. They don't check who it's to. They don't look at the amount. They don't even check to see if it has a signature on it. They just send it through. And what happens is that if you don't go back to the bank, and now it's 25 days, the bank just says, well, sorry, you know, you lost your money. And that's, you know, part of the problem. And that's basically why we wrote the bill. Of course, the people who are most vulnerable are, well, I mean, you as representatives are vulnerable to this. Your families, your mother, your father, anybody's, you know, vulnerable to this type of, you know, bad check writing. And that's why we're here, is just to change this. Also, I'd like to point out that veterans have a problem with the short time limit. Veterans who are serving in Iraq have a problem. Senior citizens have a problem because they don't always follow their, you know, bank statements, so they don't always understand what's going on. People start getting up 65 years old. They just, you know, don't quite have it, and, you know, maybe it's time for some of them to have other people take over their checking account, but many times they just, you know, try to do it as long as they can. And I have personally experienced where a member in my family, we literally had to take his checkbook away from him because he couldn't do it anymore, because he kept started doing duplicates and he wasn't checking his statements. And, you know, these are people who are vulnerable. People who are disabled, you know, are vulnerable to this. They, you know, people who depend on other people. And what it really comes down to is most of the time, in Ken Reiser's case, a whole bunch of, he had to have an accountant, or I should say a bookkeeper, do his books. But he didn't find, you don't find out until something goes wrong. You don't find out until the bank calls you up and say, gee, there's no money in your account. And then you say, well, but I had $60,000. Well, what happened to it? You know, and then you find out something happened. The other thing I'd like to point out about this check and this process is basically a bank does not have to respond to you. They, you know, if you have anything under $5,000, they're not obligated. And they just look at that as, you know, an acceptable loss. And point I'm making about $5,000 is it can be done multiple times. And going back to the bill, what the real purpose of this bill is to reduce the original is to restore the statutes back to what they were originally written, where the statutes actually say in Chapter 74 that you have 180 days to respond. That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to get rid of the variation by agreement. And you have to look at the variation by agreement under these terms. You as legislators write laws. They're spelled out specifically what you can and what you can't do. But then at the same time, somebody, or I should say, other legislatures in the past are, have written into the law, oh, well, we'll just give the banks a right to variation by agreement. That means the banks can do anything they darn well please. They can change the rules. You know, they don't even have to follow law. And that's what we're trying to get rid of, is the variation by agreement. Also, we're defining, redefining ordinary care in the check process. We're trying to eliminate the 30-day limitations. And one thing that's very important is to eliminate bank statement delays. And this is one of another problem that we face, is that if you have a problem and you go back to the bank will sit there and say, well, okay, we'll find your statement, we'll have to do this, we'll have to do that. Well, they have a 30-day, you know, 25 or 30-day limitation to start with. By the time they stall you out a couple months, you're past their deadlines. I mean, they can just do it to you, and you missed the deadlines because they delayed you just getting it. And this is why we wrote into this that if somebody goes back to a bank and says, I want a, you know, a statement of what's going on, the bank has to provide it, you know, within 24 hours. And that's really what is, you know, important. That's pretty much what the bill's about.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. Could I have Ken and Trudy Reiser, please? Good morning, sir.
Yes, sir. Good morning to you all. We are honored to be able to talk to you today.
Our honor.
Oh, it's a fine. Actually, I'm Lieutenant Colonel. I'm Colonel Kenneth L. Reiser, retired after 30 years service, and I've been at three of the major wars and whatnot. Oh, that's not too important in this case. I'm not here because to get anything for ourselves. We're working on that in another other courts. We have not been very successful. We've been turned down after one court has awarded a good $1 million suit, for instance, but we won that. Immediately, we lost it. But anyway, when I retired, and we are proceeding in court, but when I retired, I'm an Oregon boy, raised in Tillamook County, when I entered the Marine Corps at the outbreak of World War II, and I stayed in the Marine Corps for about 30 years, retired with the rank of colonel. But I wanted to come back to Oregon, and I wanted to build what we had in mind as a dream house. We built it, and it was a large, expensive home, lovely place. Actually, we built it large because we were going to put a retirement home in it, care for the elderly. An adult foster care home, and it was run by my wife. I was strong and healthy and building houses, and with the help of that home, we would pay for it very handsomely. We discovered we had a problem when the tree's back went bad. We ran the home for about 2 years, but her back friend got bad, and she couldn't run the home anymore. And I was occupied otherwise, And the people in our church kind of recommended to me, we were looking for an accountant. And they recommended somebody to come in and take over our affairs. And take over only that, to take care of the affairs, but not to really write aside the checks. We very carefully kept that control away from him. We found out that he was embezzling from us at a later date when one check couldn't be located. And we went to the bank immediately to try to start our case with the bank and see if they'd help us, talk to us. Well, it took them 2 years for them to really get serious about the thing. We'd been at home for 2 years, the adult foster home. They wouldn't help us. We had a plan of paying back the missing checks ourselves. They weren't, in some cases, they weren't even signed. And this was in excess of $67,000. And we went to the bank to try to change the payment plan. And we couldn't get that. There was no responsibility of the checks. Well, the law said we had 180 days. And so what we had to have the missing statements and the missing checks to proceed. I thought that the Oregon statute gave us 180 days. It took 3 months, and we got them by going to another bank.
Another branch.
Another branch. And just walking in and asking another branch, we had them in 3 weeks. But the bank that we had, they wouldn't give them to us. They had all kind of reasons, all kind of promises. And actually, by the bank figure, we're already in default. We were operating on what we thought the Oregon laws were. It turned out that they had ways to intentionally delay, and that 20 days, 25 days goes pretty fast. If we had the 180 days, what I understood the Oregon statute would give us, we'd have been okay. We could have come across, we filed a claim against the bank, but it was too late. And we were blocked at every turn because they had to call, blown the whistle on the 25 days and said that we were in default of their regulations. It seems to me that this is already on the Oregon statute, so all we have to do is enforce it. I'm not looking for anything in my case, but it can happen to you if you don't carefully read the back pages of the checkbook. And when you go in and open your bank account, you really have to read the back, the small print. And it's so convoluted that it's difficult to do that. They read it under any circumstance. It just, they can fill the box in front of you. And all of this action has led us to end in bankruptcy. Our home is gone. We were illegally put out of our home. And we'd been on the street, or I don't know where we'd be if a good friend hadn't volunteered to give us a loan of an apartment until we can get on our feet again. I think that the citizens of Oregon deserve a law that's not... We have a law. I just believe we ought to enforce it and not change it and not let them go to the commercial law. And work plans to stop us. Now, this, I've never been bothered by much of anything before. And this got to me, and I ended up by getting a stroke. I'm having difficulty with my speech. And I've had the left side of my body paralyzed. And I'm working on it very hard. It's been about 6 months now. And all of that is showing improvement. And we're on a plan and working on our problem. We'll do something, I don't know what, but we've got some of improvement with me getting better. And that's about it. Can you think of anything else?
Yeah, I'd like to add.
Trudy, you have some testimony. Your name and for the record, please.
My full name is Gertrude Reusser, but they call me Trudy. I just wanted to add that we had, because our claim against the bank was denied out of hand, we filed a lawsuit. We won that lawsuit. We were given a default judgment because the bank didn't pay any attention to the lawsuit. And won a money judgment, and that was legally overturned by the bank also. So no matter what we did, the bank had absolute power to do whatever they wanted and everything that we didn't want. We're still in court over that issue. And just wanted to clarify, the bookkeeper that we hired when I was too ill to keep track of the checks and just the paperwork that comes in that you have to handle, including balancing the statements, we never gave that bookkeeper authority over anything, just to do the work and to prepare the bills and to know what had to be paid when, and then to print out the checks on the computer and then give them to us to mail and to sign, of course. So the bank used that as an excuse also, and that wasn't the case. So the point of the whole thing is that the statutes were ignored, and over that we lost our home and our money. Thank you.
But we're not here for any personal gain.
Yeah, it's too late.
We think the citizens of Oregon deserve better treatment.
Yeah.
They need protection for the disabled and the elderly. 185 days or 180 days would have made a world of difference in us being able to plan and prevent that.
Right.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions?
Oh, yes. That's good, Donna. Thank you. The bookkeeper, in fact, was sent to jail over this and was given the maximum sentence allowed by law. He's still in jail. So it was acknowledged.
Representative Schaffler.
Well, for what it's worth, they should have just shot the thief and busted.
Yeah, they didn't. The law didn't allow that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you again for your testimony.
All right, sir. Thank you.
And thank you for everything you've done for the country.
I'd also like to add that some of the people in this room have been tremendous help to us.
Yes.
And I hope we can help the rest of the people some.
Thank you, sir. Jim Evans.
Good morning, Chairman Brown, members of the committee. My name's Jim Evans, and I'm an attorney in Portland. This type of situation does not run just towards Colonel Reusser. Unfortunately, we have a lot of senior citizens in our communities who have gone through this experience, and 30 days, it's a very short time frame. Sometimes people don't react as quickly as they should. Unfortunately, they come to a lawyer and say, what can I do about this after the bank has already insisted on their 30 days that they have in the back of their agreement in the small print that not everybody reads, particularly when they're opening up an account. And the toughest thing for a lawyer to have to do is to tell them, you have no recourse because the bank is sitting on their contractual rights that they have been allowed to vary from the 180-day statute. And that's probably the hardest thing, you know, and you don't hear about that as much as you, the Colonel Reiser, you know, he's a man of a lot of fortitude, a lot of strength, and he has come forward. But a lot of people feel embarrassed about these kind of situations. It's unfortunately, I would analogize it to these con artists that come by old people and do something on their home, and it's not a good job, or they take the money. People don't like admitting that they've been taken, particularly by a big, powerful organization like a bank. Now, the truth of the matter is, the reasoning behind the 180 days and why that was given that way is because historically, UCC law, the idea is that the institution is the one that is giving the authorization for the payment of the money, and their requirements have to be met. That the individual should not be held account if there's a ill factor in there, if there's someone doing something illegal, and they're basically an innocent party. And the idea is that the bank, they are the ones that are able to look over these things. They're the ones also, frankly, to be able to absorb the spread the risk, if you will, as opposed to an individual. And the individual, and I would suggest that this is a good bill to try and reduce, address this thing. And I don't think it's Colonel Reiser alone. I think it is a lot of individuals in our society for one reason or another, whether they literally, when you're talking 30 days, you might go out for a 3-week vacation and you might come back and you might find some identity theft person has ended up dealing your account a significant blow, but you're past 30 days. And at this point, the banks are very strict on that kind of thing. They basically, they look at it as a big institutional organization that's trying to reduce their risk as small as possible. And so they don't really, they take advantage of the laws as much as they possibly can, and they don't, frankly, have the empathy towards the individual. And that's one reason why they were able to just basically dust off Colonel Reiser, even though he had all this service to his country, because they didn't care. I think that the legislature should look at this bill, seriously give it consideration, and, you know, I don't really want to have to tell people anymore that, yeah, it's been 35 days and you're out of luck because this bank, this big bank, this billion-dollar bank doesn't care about your $30,000 that you lost, but frankly, to that individual, that $30,000 might be the difference between dignity and distress. And I think this committee should do something about that and should move this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Any questions? I don't see any. Thank you.
Thank you.
Could I have Ken Sherman and Tim Martinez, please?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. With me again today is Ken Sherman, counsel for the Oregon Bankers Association. I'm going to let him walk through the UCC and the technical parts of check clearing in a second. But I want to begin by certainly expressing our concern and you know, what happened to the colonel and his family is certainly a very great tragedy. Unfortunately, it does occur from time to time in our society, and I think all you need to do is read the papers and see examples of bookkeepers taking advantage not only of the elderly but of smart businessmen and women that that should know better. I would, before I turn over to Ken, just say one more thing. The person that just testified talked about the billion-dollar bank. I think it's important to know that this also affects the $100 million bank, the $50 million bank, and the $5 million credit union, and would very much put us out of compliance with national national statutes and national UCC. So with that, I would turn it over to Mr. Sherman.
Thank you, Tim. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Ken Sherman, Jr. I'm counsel for the Oregon Bankers Association. We've taken a long, hard look at this bill, and we certainly are very sympathetic to the problems that were encountered by Colonel Risser, his family. I think one of the things that I regret about this is that the association, I've been doing legal work for the association since 1977, and I've had an experience more times than I can count where a problem like this, kind of an aberration, comes to the surface, and at some point the association is called upon to step in and play a role, and unfortunately that didn't happen in this case. This is the first time that we've been in the same room with folks who are advocating on behalf of this bill, and I think it's unfortunate because we might have been able to find not only a solution to this particular problem, but a basis for some discussion on the issues that they've raised. Unfortunately, this bill would make important provisions of something called Article 4 of the Uniform Commercial Code non-uniform, and in the process would, in our opinion, destroy the delicate balance of rights that have served Oregon and the rest of the country very well for the last 40 years. The Uniform Commercial Code is without any doubt the most important and successful product of a group called the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws. This group has been in existence, I think, now for more than 100 years, and they passed dozens and dozens, they've formulated dozens and dozens of uniform state laws, many of which have been enacted here in Oregon and elsewhere. The UCC is always held up as the shining example of the importance of a uniform approach to state law in some areas. There are some areas where uniformity is not very important, but as we all know, business and commercial and financial activities are now so interstate and international in scope that we really could not operate our economy in anything like the way that we do without a great deal of uniformity, which is given to us by the Uniform Commercial Code. The UCC has been the law here in Oregon, and it is the law. There was a statement made at the beginning of the hearing that somehow the bank in this case chose to follow the UCC rather than state law. Well, let's all understand that the UCC is the state law of the state of Oregon, has been the state law of this state since 1961, so we're not dealing with something that hasn't been around for a while. It's also the state law in all 50 states. The importance of uniformity, I would suggest, has grown dramatically in the last 40 years or so as banking and commerce have become more interstate in nature. And we would submit that if Oregon is to be a full participant in the commercial life of the United States, it is vital that we do not enter into wholesale departure from its uniform provisions. Now, the First Amendment that would be made by this bill is an example of what I'm talking about. Currently, ORS 74.1030 sub 1 provides that the provisions of Chapter 74, which pertain to bank deposits and collections, that's what the whole chapter is about, may be varied by agreement between the bank and the customer so long as the agreement doesn't disclaim the bank's liability for good faith or its failure to exercise ordinary care. And that current law also provides that the parties by their agreement may determine the standards by which the bank's responsibility is to be measured, so long as those standards are not manifestly unreasonable.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative Shaw.
Rather than going over statute, really what I want to know, and this may not be the answer to it, but what are we doing, what are the banks, what's the banking industry, the finance industry, the credit unions doing to make sure this doesn't happen anymore in the state of Oregon? That's really what I want to hear.
All right. Well, thank you, Representative Schaffler, and I'll be happy to shift gears to that rather than to a discussion of the bill. I think that the first thing I'd point to is the leadership that this industry has shown in the area of elder financial abuse. And I think we had a pretty good example of elder financial abuse today. Unfortunately, the person who was really apparently at the heart, and I don't know all the details. I know what I learned in this testimony this morning, but the real culprit in this thing was the bookkeeper. And we have seen, and I have seen personally in my practice over the last 30 years, a lot of examples of this, unfortunately. Folks who get up into those higher age brackets do become more vulnerable. And I think that the Oregon Bankers Association, I know it has been held up as a national model for its leadership in helping to detect. We have been supportive of laws that that make financial abuse of the elderly a crime. So I don't think we take a second or a back seat to anyone in that regard.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Well,
I'm just a laborer. So, fortunately, I'm married to a really smart woman, okay? And if I'm lucky, I'm going to get to be the colonel's age. And if I'm even luckier, I'll have some money. My wife will make sure it doesn't get stolen from me, from some friend down at the tavern. But I really, and you know, I think it's a good lesson here that just because somebody goes to church doesn't mean they're a good person. I really want to emphasize that on the record too. But anything recently that we're doing, I want specifics about exactly what you do to elderly, with elderly folks and their accounts. To police and monitor and try and avoid some thieving, no good, worthless piece of garbage that doesn't deserve to share the same air with the colonel and his wife. Really, I think that's what I want to hear, what's going on. I believe you're a model, sir. I absolutely believe you are. But specifically, what are we doing in this state to avoid this in the banking and finance credit union industry?
Okay, well, and others may be able to speak more fully than I can to this. What I know that we are doing, so that we're not just talking the talk of elder financial abuse, but walking the walk, is engaging in a lot of in-house and inter-industry training to make our people more sensitive to and better able to spot examples of this. And I can tell you, I do a lot of elder law work in my legal practice, and the cases of this can be so subtle. I mean, it's such a fine line. I mean, you have a case like this one today, and there's no fine line involved anywhere. This is just plain felonious behavior. Mm-hmm. But so often, what's going on there is very difficult and very subtle and hard to really recognize and pin down. We're doing everything we can to train our frontline people, our tellers and the people who open new accounts and people who change accounts, the security officers within the financial institutions. We're holding classes throughout the state to try and get elderly people up to speed and to make them more sophisticated. We have supported a raft of legislation in this session and in the past session to find new ways to get at this problem. And it's not just elderly people. They're maybe the first victims, but it's not just them.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schalper, if I might interject as well, we will be happy to get you the stuff that we're doing in conjunction with the Governor's Elder Abuse Task Force. We've been involved in that for a while. But let me give you a specific example from this very session. We've spent the last 2 years working with members of the Oregon State Bar and others dealing with powers of attorney, mm-hmm. and trying to come up with some standards for powers of attorney. Well, that's proven to be a very difficult task, and one of the reasons that's proven to be a difficult task is trying to put in protections for not only elders but others that use financial services when the financial institution believes that fraud is being committed. It's a very fine balance trying to find that language, and frankly, we've decided we can't get there this session. But that's, I think, a good example of something that we're doing and we'll continue to work on to try to protect the public, including the elderly, as well as their other customers.
Thank you. One more, and then I'll drop this, Mr. Chair. What I'd also like, you guys, and the credit unions are in that room too, is some examples, specific examples, of actually where you all headed this off before it came to this. They have to be out there where your staff at the banks, the tellers, caught some no good, worthless, you know what. But you don't hear about that so much in the papers. But if those examples are out there, just a handful, just so for my own curiosity and my own knowledge.
Mr. Chair, or is there a shop that we can do that?
Can we have your written testimony? Sure. Any other questions, Representative Escobar?
Yes, I guess what my concern here is that I assumed, which obviously it was improper, that someone is looking at the signatures on checks in your bank. And that disturbs me, because I rely upon my bank to be my first safeguard against someone coming in with theft identity. The individual just stated that there are some of these checks that even have signatures on. If that's the case, I still feel the bank is responsible for
so
that
we.
Check. Having said that, what that does is puts me in a position, I go home every 2 weeks, so if I received a bank statement the day after I'd left home, by the time I reacted to it, 30 days would be gone. Is that what you're telling me?
Well, the statute that we're dealing with is 74406, and that's covered in this bill. What I'm saying is that the 30 days is the initial period. If you can show that the bank didn't exercise ordinary care in paying the check, then the period is 180 days. So the 180 days is already there, Representative. It's just that the initial period, if there was no negligence or lack of ordinary care on the part of the bank, then the 30-day period applies. But if there was negligence or lack of ordinary care, which there certainly would be if you had a blatant forgery, I mean, if you can look at a forgery and see that that's not your signature, then that's lack of ordinary care on the bank. And they simply assume the risk. If they don't check that signature, they're on the hook. And we wouldn't change that a bit. That's the balance that I've spoken to in my testimony between the responsibility of the bank on the one hand and the responsibility of the bank's customer on the other hand to check the statements. So we think that that balance, which is the law in all 50 states, not just Oregon, is very carefully crafted and works very well.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Esco, I'd be happy to get you the data on the numbers of checks that are cleared each day. It would be physically impossible in our economy today to examine each check. Now, if that is very important to you, I can tell you of one institution in the state, and I only know of one, that actually has their tellers, during the course of their day, look at checks. But it would be just physically impossible, given the size of our economy, to physically look at every check.
Mr. Chair, one more, please.
I'm Representative Schaffler.
And my wife and I both do this electronic banking. Now, today, if anybody, regardless of your age or where you're at, you can walk in and get squared away with the bank where you don't need this third party and everything's taken care of. And then the bank would be responsible. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Right. Okay. So there are ways to avoid this right now if people just go in and take advantage of it.
And, Mr. Chair, I would just echo what the Representative Schaffler is saying. Where I have my business checking account, I can go downstairs to Cafe Today and use the debit card tied to that account, and by the time I get back to my office and pull it up, it's already there. That's being used.
All right. Thank you.
Any other questions? I don't see any. Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony.
Thank you.
And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3344 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2949.
Chairman Brown?
Yeah.
Can I have her name on the
sign-up? Okay. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2949 and reopen the public hearing on House Bill 3344. Okay, I see it over there. That's all right. Janet, would you like to enter some testimony?
Thank you. I did have my name on the list.
Yeah, okay.
I'm Janet Schoenheit from Oak Grove. I want to thank you, Mr. Chairman, and all of you representatives for your work in being our state legislators. I know you really work hard. I've seen how you have to work here, and you're every minute here, there, everywhere. You hardly have time to think. So I know it must be really difficult to correct some of these problems that we all have in our state. So I feel that it is your responsibility to protect us. And When we have the UCC 30-day limitation for people to question their statements, this is 30 days, but that's from the date they send it. And then the mail takes time. So this is why I'm sure Eugene was saying 25 days, because he was considering mail time to get it to you. So if you're on vacation, more likely elderly people go on longer vacations. So it would be very easy for them to miss that time limit. And then they couldn't do anything about it. Like the risers, they had $67,000 in unsigned checks. And the bank was supposed to refund that money, and it never did. There you are. You were questioning about these unsigned checks, but it doesn't absolutely mean that that money will be returned to you. And people can be put out on the street because of this. Mr. Reiser almost died. The doctor wanted to pull the plug on him, but his wife wouldn't allow it. And here he is now recuperating. So, so I would hope that you would consider this. I understand the banks say that this is a national UCC rule, and all we can work on are state rules, state laws here, and we can correct things here in our state. After that, other states and nationally, things can be corrected to help people who get in these situations. So I don't think that we should just consider, oh, this is a national law. We don't want to go against the national law. So I feel that it is your responsibility to care for people who get into these situations, that maybe the banks don't want to destroy people's lives. They have nice people working in banks just like all other businesses, and some of them probably do catch errors and prevent theft. But you know that identity theft is a huge problem in our world, and that people are always trying to steal checks and use them for their means. So I hope you will consider this bill and think of us, because it is your responsibility, and we have to hold you to that responsibility as our representatives. Thank you.
Thank you, Janet, for your testimony. We appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Okay.
I'm going to close the public hearing again on House Bill 3344 and open the public hearing on House Bill 2949. Janet, give us a rundown on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2949 would prohibit the sale of gasoline that's blended with the abbreviation MTBE, an organic compound, in concentrations above 0.6%, becoming operative on November 1st, 2007. Mr. Chair, this compound is not currently being used in Oregon. When oxygenated fuel is required in the Portland area, a different compound is used. Ethanol is used to oxygenate the fuel. And this is somewhat of a preemptive prohibition. And that's all I have. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Randy Tucker, please.
Chair, while Randy's coming up, there's
okay.
A letter to enter into the record from the Department of Environmental Quality from Bob Danko. Should be at your places.
Thank you, Janet. Good morning, Randy.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Randy Tucker. I'm the Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro, the regional government of the Portland metropolitan area. And I'm happy to be before you today for the first time this session. Most of my business is elsewhere. So thank you for the opportunity to testify. This bill maybe as close to a freebie as you'll get this session. As Janet said, this is something that's not really, the chemical in question here is not really in use in Oregon right now. And this is a more preemptive measure than anything else. Let me, just by way of background, talk to you a little bit about why Metro is here to pursue this bill. Metro's work, we represent the region on issues that cross over jurisdictional boundaries of counties and cities that exist in the region. Mostly, those are issues having to do with the environment, which doesn't really respect political lines, and the economy, which the same. And one of those issues that straddles both the economy and the environment areas is transportation. Metro has a major role in transportation planning for the Portland region, and as part of that role, last summer, when DEQ was considering, or the EQC, I guess, was considering extending the oxygenated fuel mandate in the Portland area for vehicle fuel, which, there you go, there's the environment and the economy. That discussion took place in part in front of the Joint Policy Advisory Committee on Transportation, which is the body of regional elected and appointed officials that advises Metro on transportation issues. During that discussion, the question of what is used to oxygenate the fuel, and the oxygenating of the fuel has air quality benefits. The choices out there largely consist of ethanol, which is what's used in the Portland area, and compounds like MTBE. MTBE is a potential human carcinogen. It elsewhere in the country where it's been used, it has caused major groundwater contamination problems. It travels very quickly in the ground and contaminates water supplies. It has a strong, unpleasant odor, and people react to it quickly. It's also, as I said, a potential human carcinogen that is shown to cause cancer in animals. And so because of that, states around the country have begun to ban this chemical, and it is currently banned in both Washington and California, and as I've said, not really in use in Oregon, though there are various releases in Oregon due to it coming in other ways. Oxygenated fuel mandate was in fact extended last year and expires now on October 31st, 2007, and that's the source of the effective date in this bill of November 1st, 2007. I've been working with the lobbyists from the petroleum industry who have an interest in what they are and are not allowed to do, especially when there's a state mandate to sell oxygenated fuel, and their concern was in banning a chemical that they don't really use but that's sort of a backup for them when they're under a mandate to provide oxygenated fuel. So that's the reason we have the effective date in the statute of November 1st, 2007, the day after the expiration of the oxygenated fuels mandate. At this point, there are, I believe, 20 or so states that ban this chemical already. We wouldn't be exactly sticking our neck out here, and it's as I've said a couple times already, it's more of a housekeeping and a preemptive measure than anything else. So with that, I'd be happy to attempt to answer any questions. What I've given you is basically a fact sheet on MTBE from DEQ, which I think lays out the issues pretty straightforward manner. And I've turned in one copy of a report from the Congressional Research Service that looks at more in depth at the problems of MTBE. If you'd like more copies, I'd be glad to make the copies. If I did it downstairs this morning, it would have cost the public of my region $48 because of the prices downstairs. So I'll copy it elsewhere if you'd like me to put a full slew of copies in the record. That's it. That's all I have to say, Mr. Chair. There are other people to testify as well. I'd be glad to try to answer your questions.
Thank you, Randy. Representative Schaffer.
Thank you. I think this is a good idea. Mr. Tucker, can you get me a list of the states in the United States that have banned this, other than just the two you've mentioned?
I can provide that list, but I believe Mr. Carlson, who's behind me, has pretty updated information. He has a map that I think he's distributing to you that shows states that have already banned it and states that are considering this year banning it. The state of Washington banned it in 2001. The language of their statute is right here. It's just a sentence. I'll read to you. It says, methyl tertiary butyl ether may not be intentionally added to any gasoline, motor fuel, or clean fuel produced for sale or use in the state of Washington after December 31st, 2003, and in no event may methyl tertiary butyl ether be knowingly mixed in gasoline above 0.6% by volume. That's the source of the 0.6% language in the bill before you today. I'm actually not 100% sure that we need that threshold there, but I'll let some, you know, if anyone has any comment on that from that testifies afterwards, that'll be fine. And I understand that you're not planning a work session today on this bill, so we have time to take a look and see if that's the appropriate level.
Okay. Thank you, Randy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Could I have Brian Doherty, please?
Good morning, Chair Brown, members of the committee. My name is Brian Doherty. I'm with the Miller Nash Law Firm, and I represent the Western States Petroleum Association, which is a association of oil refiners, producers, and marketers in the West Coast. We're here not only to tell you that this bill is perfectly fine with us, but I actually offer some amendments which can't actually go into this bill because the relating clause is so tightly linked to MTBE, and I was disappointed that committee administrator Atkins wasn't willing to say methyl tertiary butyl ether. And if you look at the list, and if you look at the list of things I've given you in my written testimony, you know there's some even better tongue twisters on down the list, and these are also ethers and heavy alcohols that can be mixed as an oxygenate that should probably be included. And the language I'm taking out of here is out of the Arizona bill, which had an MTBE ban, and then they amended it to include these other heavy alcohols and ethers. And if we want to do this properly, I think we ought to have all those. You have things called ETBE, and I'll pronounce it if you want, but I have to look at it again. I can't remember how it's done. But these are all have similar characteristics as MTBE in terms of their movement through ground and their movement into groundwater. And right now, as we said, the states of Washington and California ban MTBE, as does the Olympic Pipeline, bringing over 70% of our fuel to Portland. MTBE is a derivative of the oil refining process. It can be there in trace amounts, and I think the 0.6 you're talking about is that is simply it's an oil-based product where ethanol is a bit product based from bringing corn stalk or other things you have in it, and it's separated. So what you find for the DEQ testimony is there's very trace amounts found in Oregon, and they're not being used by any of our companies or any of the jobbers or others, and they haven't been for quite some time, any MTBE being used. What this would put is pretty much eliminate everything else but ethanol. Ethanol is not a heavy alcohol, it's a light alcohol, and so it would not ban ethanol being used. And with that, I'm not sure. I know Ms. Atkins has been looking to see if there is a bill with appropriate relating clause to add this. I will work with her to see if that can be done. If it cannot, we can bring this bill back and deal with it as it is. And I'd be glad to answer any questions if you have any.
Thank you, Brian. Randy, did you see this list?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I have no objection to this, but I'm not, I meant to say when I introduced myself and Metro's interest in this, this is a little far afield from what Metro usually gets involved with, and so I don't think we have even anyone on our staff that is an expert on the chemical composition of gasoline. I'm We certainly have no objection to eliminating these other compounds that I think are used sort of to get around the MTBE ban, possibly. I'm not sure, Brian. We're fine with it, and we're fine with without it.
All these things are mean, nasty stuff.
Yes, Chair Brown, they have the same characteristics as MTBE in many ways in terms of the way they react.
Okay. Again.
Including tert amyl methyl tifer.
Mr. Chair. Easy for you to say, Mr. Doherty.
They're all CLSNs, chemicals with long, scary names.
Any questions? Representative Holden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering if you know if any of these CLSNs that are listed on this are ingredients in biodiesel, which is also being proposed in the current legislature.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, I can't answer that. I'm about as deep as Mr. Tucker is in terms of chemical knowledge. I can find out for you, and I'd be glad to get you an answer.
I appreciate that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, the next witness, I believe, if you have Mr. Carlson next, mm-hmm. actually is in the ethanol industry. He may okay. actually be able to answer some of these questions. I don't want to set him up unfairly, though.
Any questions? Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. Thank you, Ryan,
Thank you.
For this. Could we have Charles Carlson and David Smith?
Hi, Mr. Chair, Representatives Committee, I want to thank you for letting me testify today. My name is Charles Carlson. I'm president of Cascade Grain Products, which is an ethanol plant that's in Columbia County. And I'm here in support of eliminating MTBE. You should have a handout in front of you that looks something like that, or should be coming around. That does show all the states that are currently both banned and proposing a ban. There's currently 20, roughly, give or take, because the legislatures are meeting daily. And it looks like in Senate Bill 293 in the state of Montana will actually make through the ban today, so it may have already had been added. But there's currently 20 to 21 and another 6 to 8 that are considering. So, again, about half of our states by this end of this legislature should have a ban on MTBE. I put the other map from the Department of Ag showing where we've had some impact on MTBE in the state of Oregon. And I come here more on my own personal, because one of them is the town of Spray. My daughter happened to be rodeo queen there one time, so that's one of the issues that I have in on my own side for supporting this ban of MTBE and the fact that it is head there. So I can answer your questions, but quite honestly, on that list of chemicals, I know about half of them.
Mm-hmm. All right, David?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dave Stewart Smith. I'm the Assistant Director for Energy Resources for the Oregon Department of Energy, and I'm appearing here today to also encourage you to support this bill. Methyl tertiary butyl ether and other chemicals like it. The one that was mentioned, ETBE, is just ethyl tertiary butyl ether, and it varies only slightly from the MTBE chemical configuration, and it presents the same kind of problem. We believe that these types of chemicals are an inappropriate addition to our mix of fuels, that we should work as hard as we can to make motor fuels as benign as we can to the environment. And one of the ways that we can do that and help the Oregon economy is to encourage in every way possible the addition of ethanol to our motor fuels and biodiesel for those engines that use diesel. Ethanol is an oxygenate, so it can be used for the same purpose as MTBE. It also is an octane booster, as is MTBE, and can be used in the same way. So one of our concerns at the department with a ban on MTBE in many other states is we may find ourselves in a position without this bill where a product can be sold that is losing its market share elsewhere. And there may, even though it is not used to any significant extent today, we may find Oregon as a dumping ground for a product that is unwelcome in many other places around the country, and we want to make sure that doesn't happen. And there are there's a great deal of effort, as Mr. Carlson mentioned, to try and work to get ethanol as an important mix in our motor fuels, not only for air quality reasons, but to try and make our motor fuels more renewable in nature. Because ethanol produced from either grain or hopefully in the future from waste products like paper and wood waste and things like that will allow us to wean ourselves to a greater extent from imported petroleum products that are having a pretty tough time on our economy. So with that, I would be happy to answer any questions the committee would have.
Any questions? Representative Holden.
Well, I'll ask the same question. I don't know if you've seen this list of other chemicals. Do you know if propanol or some of these others, any of those ingredients are in biodiesel?
Methanol is used in the production of biodiesel. Biodiesel is oftentimes made from waste oils, waste fats from the food products industry, and through a chemical reaction with methanol, turned into the methyl ester of. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I have to confess to being an analytical chemist by training. Methanol is used in the production of biodiesel, and it's possible there may be some unreacted methanol in biodiesel. I'm not an expert on all of these chemicals. Normal propanol is often sold in drugstores as rubbing alcohol. Many of these are fairly common chemicals, and I don't know the extent to which they are used might be used, but I'd be happy to do a little more research on that with the other witnesses, but my point is still the same. If we are going to use an oxygenate in our fuels in this state, I would prefer to see it be ethanol, which we can produce in this state as soon as we can get a few of these plants built around the state using agricultural products.
I think one thing to throw out here in this section, this does not apply to diesel. We're just talking on Ed Hill under 646.910. It's only talking about gasoline.
Okay.
But diesel is not in that part of this.
Agreed. Thanks.
Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony today. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2949 and open the public hearing on House Bill 3080. And Janet, can you give us an explanation of the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3080 would create a timber producer lien that was for the amount of the price of the forest products that are transferred to a purchaser. The lien would be would specify that the lien attaches to all forest products and other inventory for sales proceeds that are in the possession of the purchaser, regardless of the source of those other items. It would specify that except for tax liens, the lien created by the producer of the timber is superior to all other liens or security interests in forest products, inventory, or proceeds of a purchaser, regardless of the relative timing of other liens. So the other liens could be prior in time, but this would take timber lien would become a priority lien when it does attach. It specifies that the producer of the timber does not need to file notice to perfect the lien unless the lien is extended beyond the 45 days after payment was due. And it does terminate a lien against a cutter of timber upon the creation of the lien by the producer against the purchaser. Mr. Chair, there are current lien statutes and you can see for timber production, and you can see them because they're in Section 8 of the bill, and that's where they're amended. So that's the existing lien that a timber producer and cutter has. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Good to have Representative Smith and Leroy Smith.
He was going to testify later.
Mr. Chair.
You won't let him have his word along with you?
I can't believe he's even testifying. I wanted to have Chuck Taylor from Legislative Council join me. So
pardon?
We could answer Lean questions. He's
okay.
If you had any questions on
sure.
Lean and who wrote the bills. Chuck Taylor from Legislative Council. So.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
For the record, I'm Representative Patty Smith. Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. I represent District 52, East Clackamas, East Multnomah, and Hood River County. It seems like I've been here before, just too recently. I'm here today to ask you to support House Bill 3080, sponsored at the request of the Oregon Small Woodlots Owners Association. And this bill does several things. It replaces existing provisions for a lien on cut timber with a provision for a priority lien in inventory and sales proceeds of purchaser. And Janet actually gave my speech for me. I was going to try to tell you what this bill does. What this bill does is changes the lien process and makes it for small woodland owners. They are now subordinate to the lien process, and this gives them the opportunity to be a priority lien. After all, they grow the trees, and it's their stumpage, and so this process makes it better. It allows a small forest owner the right to notice a lien, a process that they have not had. They simply had to hope that in good faith they would get paid for their timber. It's a much-needed lien process, and I'm sure you'll hear from many landowners today how it's affected them. My husband being one of them, he and his family own timber property and have gone through this process and had this affect them greatly. And I'm sure there are other people here to testify. I know there are. I just met several. So I just kind of wanted to tell you why we brought the bill. It's a much-needed bill, and I wish it were in my committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Schaffler.
Thank you, Representative. I agree. We have to protect these woodland owners' investment and the products and the labor that they provide us. And I, as a contractor, have a bond. So if I screw up, property owners made whole. Would you be opposed to something along those lines rather than a lien? Because my concerns are that, you know, the person, the banker that lends out the money for the equipment would become second. Not only that, but I think under this, the laborers would be second to the woodland owner, too. I want everybody to get paid.
Right.
I've discussed this with the woodland owners lobbyists, and I want them to get their money. I know the turnaround on this investment, as you and Leroy, you and your husband know, it's really wide, and I don't. So my question to you is, would you be willing to look at other ways than a lien, rather a bond or something like that? Are you flexible to something?
I think
like
I'm
that?
Flexible on that, and I would
right.
ask that maybe you ask that after
right.
we hear the testimony, Mr. Chair and Representative right. Schaffler. I think what we have to do is solve the problem, and I'm for looking for solutions for sure.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Okay. As I read the bill, the timber grower would become, let's say you have a scenario, you got a sawmill that's going out and they buy in timber, and he goes to the grower and makes a deal to buy their timber at such a price, and then he goes hires, I'm not sure how this works, but I would assume that he hires spallers, and then he'll hire a logging company to come in and with their tower to bring the logs up to where they can haul, and then they will hire a hauler. And this would, and these people would also, say the mill goes belly up, then these people would probably all file a lien of some kind too to protect their interest. But this would put the grower then ahead of all those other people, not necessarily just the bank, but the other people that provided services also to get these things to the woods. Is that right?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'll try to answer that. The way I understand it is the timberland owner has to pay those people anyway. They have to pay their harvest severance tax. They have to pay their people that have hauled the timber. And these people, I'm sure the producers can explain to you better how that works. But what happens is when they get to the mill, the stumpage becomes the ownership of the mill. So if it goes bankrupt, the only one who doesn't get paid is the owner of the property, the owner of the timber. So
I would think they'd have a claim against the, I know they'd have a claim against the landowner.
Representative Shaw.
Thank you. And I don't want you walking out of Representative thinking I'm not with you. I definitely want to solve this problem. And not only all those folks they owe money, but then you, the landowner, are stuck with trying to reforest this and don't have any money to reforest, which we all want to do that so the state can continue to benefit from the not just the revenue, but the jobs and the products that we all demand from the wood fiber industry here in the state of Oregon. So I just want you to know that I'm sympathetic. I'm with you. I'm just looking for solutions that will keep everybody whole.
Thank you, Chair Brown and Representative Schaffer. I appreciate that, and I, too, want to find a solution to this. You know, it's a huge burden upon the small woodland owner who produces the timber in this state. As we, you know, cut less on federal and state lands, we rely upon our private property owners, and so we have to protect them. They cannot take this kind of burden placed upon them. We did this same in the agricultural industry several years ago. As you well remember, the seed growers were having the same kind of problems. They couldn't get their money, and, you know, big bankruptcies and everyone, of course. And it's where you're at in that list of liens. You know, if there's no money left, by the time they get to you, guess what? You don't get any. So.
Yeah. And my questions was just to understand what the pecking order was here, or would be, with this bill and what exists now. And of course, maybe the scenario I was painting there is not the way it works in the industry. Maybe the people selling the timber are the ones that are hiring the loggers and the...
They are.
They are, as opposed to the mill.
Well, I think it can be both, Chair.
And so there is a possibility these people could also get left out in the cold, too, at the same time.
Well, for, thank you.
For work that
and I'm sure there are other people here that can explain, and maybe you'll get a better picture of that. Do you have anything to add, Mr. Taylor?
No, simply that is correct. That with regard to the inventory of logs and other wood products, it would be the timber producers who have priority over anyone else, and they would be equal with each other.
And that's what this bill does.
And it sounds like, in reading the bill, if I understand it, that it could be a finished product there on their site, too. It could be the lumber.
Correct. That's correct.
All right. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative.
Could I have Christina McNitt and Ray Wilkinson and Sarah Lyman? I can't. Okay. All three.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Christina McNitt, and I'm representing the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. We're a voluntary trade association of non-industrial woodland owners, typically family forest landowners. And surprisingly enough, non-industrial landowners represent almost half of all the privately held forest land in the state of Oregon. And we represent approximately 16% of the timber harvested in Oregon on an annual basis. With me today is one of our members, Sarah Lyman. She's representing her family holdings, Coast Range Conifers, which are located in Monroe. House Bill 3080, you just heard, was represented or was requested at the Oregon Small Woodlands Association's request and sponsored by Representative Patty Smith, and we appreciate that very much and her effort on behalf of this bill. We meant it to attempt to address a sporadic but very devastating issue, which is when a landowner sells timber to a mill that then subsequently goes bankrupt. House Bill 3080 would establish an automatic lien and a priority status for the forest product, the producer, on the forest products in the inventory. So not on the mill, not on the capital equipment, not on the items that a mortgage might be based on, but on the inventory of that mill, which, of course, is our product. While provisions of House Bill 38 affect every timber owner in the state, and I just wanted to emphasize this, not just the small woodland owners who would be affected by provisions in this of this bill, it would disproportionately affect small woodland owners. Typically, our guys harvest maybe once or twice in their entire lifetime. They carry their trees over a 20 or 40-year rotation. They might have 10, 40 acres. They harvest those once. They see that as a retirement investment or a college education. And you can imagine the devastating effect on a family in the event that they don't get their funds back from selling that timber. Not only is that a lost investment that they've accrued over time, but then they don't have the funds to pay their loggers. They don't have the funds to pay the transportation. They don't have the funds to pay the consulting forester that helped them go through the Forest Practices Act and laid out the sale to begin with. They don't have the funds to pay their harvest tax, which they still have to pay even though they're not being paid for the product. And they wouldn't have money to pay for reforestation costs and other costs of good forest management. So with that, I'm going to pass the baton to Sarah, who has gone through this process herself personally, and then to Ray Wilkerson from the OFIC, and we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Thanks. My name is Sarah Lyman, as Christina said, and my family, we're forest landowners. We've got property in Lincoln County and Lane and Benton counties. And we contract with loggers to harvest our timber. So, you know, we're the ones that I'm the managing partner of the company, and I'll find a logger and negotiate a price and contract with a logger to cut and harvest and haul the timber to a mill, which could be a sawmill, or it could be a veneer plant, could be a chipping facility, or some other kind of purchaser. I guess I always assumed that the logs were ours until they were paid for, from the standing tree all the way until it was used, you know, in the mill. And I was surprised to find out that that wasn't really true. A few years ago, we harvested and delivered logs for a 2-week period. It was the end of a parcel or a section that we were a piece of land that we were harvesting. It was at the end of the time that we were harvesting, and there was 2 weeks worth of logs going in, which added up to be quite a large volume. And then we were told that the mill was going bankrupt. And you know, I go down to the mill, and there was lots of logs in the yard there. But we couldn't. I said, well, just, you know, either I'll go search through and I'll find the ones with my brand on it, or, you know, give me an equivalent of it. They were already scaled and we knew what the volume was and the type of logs, and we'll just take them away and I'll go sell them somewhere else, you know. Well, I couldn't do that because, you know, once they get unloaded, they're the mills. They're not ours any longer. That's what I learned. And I found out we couldn't put a lien, you know, on the company to get paid. And I can't really see now how it's any different. I know maybe you're talking about construction, that it's any different than a job where a supplier will bring a load of lumber or something out to a job site, right? And if they don't get paid by the developer, that they're going to be able to place a lien on the property that the developer has. To me, it's pretty much the same thing. Not only didn't we get paid, this has been, you know, I'll repeat this because it's true, we didn't get paid for our logs, but we were obligated to pay our logger and the truckers and the harvest taxes. So even though we didn't get paid for the logs, we had to pay the harvest taxes, which are due as soon as it's measured, and they were measured, so we, you know, at that time we had to pay the harvest taxes, and we were also required, obligated to reforest. I mean, we want to reforest, but we're also obligated under the Forest Practices Act to reforest. So we weren't paid, yet we had to pay the cost of getting the timber from the land to the mill and replant. My next surprise was that with the bankruptcy proceedings, I found out we were listed as an unsecured creditor. And we were the absolute last folks to be paid anything. Absolutely the last position, I think. All the banks were ahead of us. In fact, even the owners of the sawmill company weren't liable for a thing. So, you know, there we were, sort of left holding the bag. And you think, well, you're supplying the wood that's going to keep this, you know, start the whole process of this company. And there you are. So I think that we as suppliers of logs should have the same right to place a lien on a mill who doesn't pay. That we're delivering logs to good faith. And I think Representative Smith was talking about the grass seed people, and this is another situation where I think of if we had grass seed to sell to an elevator and the elevator went down, we would be able to put a lien on that company. It seems to me that logs should be the same. In fact, you can compound all the problems that we had by about 50 times, since it takes about 50 years to replace the timber that we lost. It's tough. We sell timber almost every year on a sustainable basis. So, I mean, it's hurting us as much as it hurts the person that only harvests once every 10 or 20 years. And as a last comment, there was some Representative Schaffler was mentioning about a bond as an option to guarantee payment, and it just seems to me that would create another whole cost of doing business that in the long run we, the suppliers, are going to be paying for it. And it would punish the solvent companies, by making them have a bond. The beauty of this bill is nothing happens unless somebody goes bankrupt. I mean, it's totally in the background. When and if that happens, and it happens, we know it happens from time to time. I can think of three different mills in my area that it's happened to over the past, 10 or 15 years. This thing kicks in, and I think it would be much better than a bond. I don't think there would be too many people left in the unsecured creditor part. There would be some, there probably would be. It just seems like if you're the one supplying the logs, you should be able to get paid for those logs.
Okay. Sarah, even if you were, and I know that with branding of logs now, I assume that's done to prevent the theft of timber, mostly. But that's, you can pretty well identify which those trees out there in that log deck are yours. You still can't repossess them?
Well, you can't. No. As soon as they get unloaded, you can't go in there and find them. Even if you could find them, okay, it would be hard. Number one, not every log is on a load is branded, and not all on both ends. I mean, you can just imagine the physical problem, although I was willing to try, sometimes they take it straight from the log truck. They put it in a hot deck, which means it goes straight into the mill. So, it could have gone into the mill, even though, there's lots of logs you see out there, right? That inventory is there. And you can't even request to have an equal amount or type, kind of rescale it and load it out. No. So, I don't understand. The part that I understand is they're not yours after they're in that deck. So
that's far different. I sell tires, and I've sold all them to log truckers, and I can guarantee you if they don't pay me and I can find that truck, I get my product back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Right. I know you'd think that should be the right thing to do, but
not on my tires.
We're not able to do it.
Representative Coffer.
Ms. Lyman, we're trying to establish with this bill a pecking order for lien.
Right.
And the reason I brought that up is I'm trying to get rid of the opposition to the pecking order. I know it's going to cost more. Anytime you want to lessen your risk in business, you got to pay something. That's why we have insurance and bond and these kind of things. But I'm just looking for ways to get rid of opposition to make sure you get paid,
sure.
Those operators get paid, those laborers get paid. Everybody, the families, those loggers out there working in the forest, they got families too. And I want to make sure they get paid, too.
I do, too.
That's all I'm trying to do here. I don't care what we do, as long as everybody's kept whole. And the less opposition we can get to something, the sooner we're going to get there.
Yeah.
I don't care what we do, as long as you're kept whole and everybody's kept whole.
And maybe that's, I don't know. I know that the people that own the timber that's, being sold to places, we're kind of at the mercy of... how do we know if a company's solvent, you know, when we're selling our logs? It's a good faith thing. I mean, yeah, I keep my ear to the ground, you know, very closely, especially after this experience and other experiences I've heard of. But that still doesn't mean that it's not going to happen. Or does that mean, well, now maybe I can only sell to a really big company who I know is probably not going to go bankrupt, and I can't sell the local company that is really important to our business too, because, well, you know, I don't know, or I might have to buy a bond, or, you know, what if some do and some don't, or, you know, I just see that as a real problem. So anyway.
Representative Holley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Lim, I have a question about simply if a mill owner goes bankrupt and has your logs, and you had hired the contractors to do the logging, and say, for example, not that this has happened, but
right,
you didn't pay them,
mm-hmm,
are they able to lien your property to recover payment, or
yeah,
are they stuck trying to lien the logs as well?
I don't know the answer to that. You know, I felt morally obligated to pay the loggers, and we were able to do it because, you know, we have enough cash flow to do it. I mean, I think there were situations where the loggers didn't get paid from small owners, you know, because they were going to use the money they got from the mill to pay. And I don't know what happened. I think some of them just never did get paid. How can you put a lien on the logs if you're not getting paid for the log? You know, if you're not getting paid for the logs, I don't know how they would do that anyway.
Yeah, I was just wondering what kind of lien rights the logger had.
Sure. Janet, I think Janet can answer.
Current line, you can see it in Section 8 of the bill. Is that a person who performs labor or assists in obtaining, handling, or manufacturing or transporting timbers or wood products has a lien upon those timbers and those wood products for the reasonable or agreed to value, but it's the same logs, and they're not in their possession either, so it's the same issue.
But I think they could also come back against me because I hired them to do it and I didn't pay. I don't know. I'm not an attorney, but...
Thank you.
Representative Escobar.
Well, and you're probably correct. They can probably come back against you because you have the contractual agreement with them, whether it be verbal or written. But the three things I'd like to ask. One is that when you and your business practices, I wouldn't care whether a warehouser or it was ABC logging down the street here, do you not look into a letter of credit from the banking industry that backs up this mill and or like was alluded to, a performance bond, or do you not do a UCC filing for the total amount of your footage that you're sending into that mill?
No. None of that.
Why?
None of that. Yeah, well, maybe. Maybe we should be. I mean,
UCC filing would take precedence, I would assume, over a substantial amount once you leaned and they agreed to that lien.
I'm not sure what that is.
Well, you can encompass their assets and their personal assets as well.
You mean have them sign something that they're going to...
Correct.
Yeah, that's not...
Like borrowing money.
Not standard practice at all. Reputation is a lot in this business, but we don't know if, you know, some company that's been there for a while, right, you know, is, you know, what normally happens. I was trying to explain this to Christina. In my experience, when these bankruptcies happen, is when market's going like up, like that, and so everybody's out there, right, trying to make it, and then it goes like that, and they're still going like that, and... You know, that's when these things happen, and that's not standard practice at all. And maybe it should be. I mean, you know, at least the banks, they have access to all that stuff and the manpower to, I mean, like you say, I'm not even sure what a UCC, you know, I'm not an expert on those things, and yeah, there's a lot of money at stake here, and maybe we as a group should be doing that. But we aren't, we don't, it doesn't happen. We don't know the financial solvency or health or the management of and you wouldn't always be able to you'd have to have some kind of a guarantee, and we don't do that. We certainly, like I said, even the owners of the company that went bankrupt on us did not have any personal responsibility. We tried to get that after the fact, but we weren't able to.
Ray?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Ray Wilkinson with the Oregon Forest Industries Council. I'll be brief. This is, like Randy Tucker, the first time I've been before this committee this session, too. So just by way of introduction, our organization is very much like Christina and Sarah's organization. Only difference is our members have larger ownerships, but we basically represent private forest landowners. The breakpoint traditionally is 5,000 acres, so our members' ownership ranges from 5,000 acres up to over 1 million acres. A few of our members are publicly traded corporations, but most of them are privately held family businesses. So they're, and a good share of them do not have processing facilities, so they're basically tree farmers who market their logs to mills wherever they can get the best price. So the business model is identical to the small woodland owners for most of our members. We do support this bill. We have more, our members harvest more regularly, so they don't have the devastating effects when this sort of thing happens as a small landowner does, but the impact is the same. I'm not an expert on lien law or security interests, but it strikes me that this bill is a common sense, kind of an effective way of allowing a log timber landowner to recover the price of logs delivered to a mill when a bankruptcy occurs. And I think there's some practical things in here that's been mentioned already. You don't have to identify and segregate your specific logs out of a log deck. The lien could also apply to manufactured product that's still on the yard. And I know there's probably going to be opposition to this bill, but it's common sense tells me that if a bank has a line of credit or is loaned money for operating expense, that their recovery ought to be against the land that the mill sits on, the building, the plant and equipment. There's plenty of other assets other than the timber producer's logs, and it seems like the timber producer ought to be the one that has first priority, first place for the logs that are in a deck or in the 2x4s that are sitting in the yard. So with that, I appreciate your time, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to thank the people that brought this bill forward. I had the opportunity during the interim to serve as an individual that oversaw the harvesting of a small stand of timber and was brokering out. And in fact, I talked to Leroy about it, who I was good to see. And this business is, fortunately or unfortunately, done on a word of mouth, and it's one of the few that are still done with a handshake, and I got to tell you, it was probably one of the most enjoyable business transactions that I've been a part of, because the people that are harvesting, that are cutting, and quite frankly, once the stuff is cut and is sent out, the logger then takes the wood and is divvying it out to various different mills depending on the size and the grade and the quality and the height and the circumference and where they can get the best price and the type of timber that's within the stand of timber. I mean, it's very, very complex, and anything that we can do as a committee, I'm more than happy to head up a work group on something like that if this is the chair's prerogative. Just had a little bit of experience with it, and I think I can understand both concerns. So,
Representative Shoffman.
Thank you, Ms. Lyman. Do you still do this on a handshake?
What we do is we'll get a purchase order from the mill, which will delineate all the particulars of their company and our company and the harvest notification number that we have to file with the state and approximate volume and the price is going to be paid and the terms, that it's going to be paid at a certain, time period. And then we both sign that. So, but it's a one or two pager. It's not a contract, with a letter of credit or anything else. We're going to supply the logs and they're gonna pay us for them, and it's gonna go through a scaling bureau, and that's gonna be certified. So it's not really a handshake, but I think there is a they can't operate without us, and we can't operate it without them. I mean, that's just a fact of life to me. I would hate to get into a situation where you're sort of somewhat hostile to each other. Because that's not really the way we want to be. I don't know if that answered your question or not.
That's fine.
Just follow up on that there. I think anyone that's selling merchandise of any kind, whether it's a log or whether it's a tire, that it's in your best business interest to do whatever you can to protect your interest. And it's not a matter of courtesy. It's just a matter of good business.
Yeah, I guess, you know, some of us would have the ability to do that, and a lot of us wouldn't, you know, because, you know, just depending on your size and your smarts. I mean, you know, the fact that the 40% of the private land that the small owners have, I mean, a lot of it's not their primary business. I mean, it is my primary job for my family. I'm the one who does it for my family, and I don't even know, you know, a lot of this stuff. And certainly, you know, mom and pop down the road know even less. It just doesn't seem like it's much different than, I think Ray said it really well, that those logs, you see those logs out there, and it just, I think there's other places that those should be, you know, we should use those to secure what we've delivered, and perhaps the banks can be satisfied that they're not going to be based on the inventory that hasn't even been paid for. I mean, it doesn't seem right to me.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate it. Leroy? Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Chair Brown and committee. Thanks for the opportunity to be here. My name is Leroy Smith. I live in Corbett. Some people know my wife, Patty. My family has owned timberland for a number of years, and my son and I currently have a logging contracting business that we mainly log on family-owned property. However, we do contract logging on private properties around our area. We've experienced three bankruptcies. One was a exporter a number of years ago, and it probably wasn't legal, but we came out real well in that because our guy that was hauling them, it went down, and they did bring the logs back home again. Probably didn't do it legally, we don't know, but we didn't lose any money on that one.
I've had that experience too.
The next two were the Hannell Lumber Company in Hood River, that had a great reputation, been in business for years, sold, and we dealt with them. We had timberland about 8 miles away from the mill. It was handy for a lot of our products. When that company that bought from Hannell went bankrupt, it's a sudden thing, you know, how them happen. Although we did get a little forewarning, we knew a lot of the people at Hannell's, and a couple of them said, I think there's a problem, and we did quit selling. But we had about $85,000 worth of our own family timber that we had logged in the mill. And about a year and a half later, we did get 30 cents on the dollar on our $85,000. During that bankruptcy proceeding, another company bought the bankrupt company and went back in business, and we saw all of their literature and their finance and everything. It looked really great, but we kind of was watching it too, and it went on for a couple of years, and they also went bankrupt on us. And we are into that for about $75,000, and we haven't got anything from that, and we don't anticipate getting anything. So we did see that happen. It happened really quickly, and we knew them people. They did our mechanic work in their shop and stuff, so we knew the company really well, but these bankruptcies can happen real sudden. And in the contracting, we haven't been contracting timber for somebody else and faced a bankruptcy, but I can see the real problem there, because the landowner comes to us, he's got 20 acres of trees that he's been growing for a number of years, and we have a reputation in the area, and he trusts us to come in and log it for him. And so we write up something, the terms and stuff, but as the previous witness says, it's not a big, long, lengthy contract. But we go in there, and we're a small operator, but if we are logging, say, 6 loads a day of timber, on the landowner's tract, and it's, you know, 4,000 feet of load or so. You're talking about 25,000 feet a day. So in 10 days, typically the mills will pay, some of them pay weekly, some of them pay twice a month. So it'd be very easy to have 10 days or even more of logs in the mill when that you discovered that you weren't paid for the previous pay period. So you could easily have, you know, 100,000 feet or more in that mill, even a small operator like us. So if the bank, if the thing goes in, we're, as the witnesses said, we're way down the list on our recovery. So we're probably not going to get paid, or if we do, it's going to be very little. Well, what do we do with the landowner? Because he's trusted us to sell his logs, and we've tried to find the right mill and whatever. So the landowner then is stuck, of course, for his 40 or 50-year-old trees that he's going to have to wait to grow again and replant. We're stuck for the trucking. We have to pay our trucker, whether we get paid or not, our people that we hire, followers and such, and, of course, our own costs. So fortunately, we haven't faced that, but I know that people in the industry that have faced that very problem. So you'll notice sometimes, a lot of times, and I know it happened in Hood River, when the mill goes, you look around and there's, I know of one family in Hood River, it totally wiped them out. They got caught in both the bankruptcies the same as we did, and the second one, totally, they lost, one of them lost their home and everything. It was really tragic. So we need this kind of bill. I think it's a real practical, I think it makes a lot of sense. And as I mentioned, the banks and mortgage investment people have the assets other than the logs and the product or their liens and their mortgages. We're just asking for the ones that we supplied, the parts that we supplied. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Leroy. Thank you again. Could I have Ken Sherman and Tim Martinez, please? Mm-hmm.
Good morning again, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I know you're running out of time, so we'll try to be brief. Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. And to my right, Ken Sherman, counsel for the Oregon Bankers Association. Let me just begin by saying we appreciate the sponsor's comments when she testified that she was certainly reasonable and willing to look at other solutions than the bill you have before you. I'm not surprised that we think the bill you have before you would not be the way we would proceed if given the offer of the choice. I think, you know, you've heard some good testimony from folks in the business. You know, when I think about good business practices and standards of practice, I think about Representative Escoval. You know, if he were to try to sell all the thousands of properties he sells down in Southern Oregon on a handshake, or Representative Brown trying to do the same thing with all his tire sales. The fact of the matter is that, again, Oregon and the world economy has changed, and we do need sometimes to have protections in place. Those protections are in place right now for small woodland owners. They can, like anybody else, file a UCC. UCC is getting easier and easier to file over time. In fact, now you can actually file them electronically, I believe. So, you know, it's not an additional burden or a huge additional burden from our perspective. I just look at myself as an example, as a small business guy. I certainly trust all my clients, and we certainly do a lot of business by handshakes, but I also have a contract backing up my accounts, and I think that's important for all of us. So as I said, they can be a UCC, they can be a secured creditor as opposed to a non-secured creditor. The problem in bankruptcy, obviously, is not everybody gets paid when there's bankruptcies, and that's just a fact of life. That's probably not going to change. And I would just point out, you know, and this is kind of tongue-in-cheek, but I'll throw it out there anyway. When you're looking for a solution, you might just look at the beer guys in dealing with the grocery stores. When you deliver beer to a grocery store, you get paid in cash. No cash, no beer. You know, that might be a solution they want to look at in this case. And with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Sherman.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
I thought it was no beer, no work.
That's the sign that you hold the sign.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I know your time is short. I've presented you with written testimony that goes through the details of our concerns about this bill. I'm not going to just read that to you. I just want to reiterate that there really are, in this case, not one but two existing solutions, three existing solutions. Tim facetiously referred to the first one, sell for cash. And obviously some of these sales do occur on that basis, and that's an obvious solution. But there are going to be lots of situations where the timber landowner is going to be a creditor because the cash isn't available at the moment of the sale to pay them the full price. And so what do? Well, they've already got in 87-222 a timberland owner's lien that is available and covers them for the first $125,000. That was put in by the 1999 legislature when the same complaint came forward, and that was the compromise that was come up with. We said, why don't you just file UCC security interest? Well, we're not very sophisticated, and we don't want to get into all of that detail, especially on these small sales. So the compromise was, if your sale was under $125,000, we'd create this special statutory lien. It's already on the books, 87-222. But for larger sales where you've got more sophisticated folks, there's nothing complicated about filing a security interest and financing statement under Article 9 of the Uniform Commercial Code. I think it's important to keep in mind that the reason we created the Uniform Commercial Code, and I hate to be a broken record on this, but it was to bring uniformity and some sense of predictability to the commercial industry, not only with regard to payment of checks, but with regard to security interests and priorities. The major problem with this lien, and this is not the first, Oregon has a disturbing history of creating yet another secret lien for every special interest group that asks for it. But the problem with these things is that when you create a secret lien in any class of collateral, everybody else out there that's dealing with those businesses is flying blind. They have no idea what's out there because it's secret. And this is a lien that stays secret from the moment the logs leave the land until 45 days, not after the delivery, but 45 days after the final payment for those logs is due. If there's a two-year contract, we're talking 2 years and 45 days before the bank or anyone else even knows that there's a credit problem with regard to this lien. And yet it takes priority over everything else, and several of you expressed concerns about some of these other folks that are providing inputs to the harvesting and processing of this. It takes priority over them too. This is a bad solution. We really don't think there is a problem. We think that the problem is, as one of the folks testified, there's not, for whatever reason, a great deal of understanding of the UCC or sophistication about it. But I don't know why this group of creditors is unique among all the world. Why are they unable to abide by these rules that everybody else abides by? You know, we've got thousands of people in Oregon every year who sell their homes, their most prized possession, on credit. And I suppose, you know, what they do if they do it right is they sell it on a land sale contract or they sell it on a note and trust deed or a note and mortgage. And they're fully secured. And their priority's right up there at the top. Now, if we had some of those people who said, well, I'll just do it on a handshake. You know, here's my most prized possession. Take my house and run, and I'm an unsecured creditor. Then maybe you'd have a bunch of those folks coming in saying, well, give us a priority lien, a lien that we don't have to tell anybody about that jumps over everybody else. I don't think that would be a good solution in the real estate field, and it's certainly not a good solution in this area. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
In the $125,000 that's in the statute now, what priority does it have? Is that first?
No, I don't think it is. And I'm not sure of that. I didn't go back and research that, but I think it takes priority from the date that it's filed. That's my recollection. But I'd be happy, Mr. Chairman, to research that and get back to you.
Please, Representative Shoffman.
Thank you. You know, I've had
pleasure of spending an evening with Mr. Smith, and he enlightened me about the investment that these folks make in their property, in this state, including protecting and restoring water quality, salmon habitat. Are you nice guys willing to sit back down with these nice folks and try? There's a problem here, and I believe a problem exists. Maybe it is just a matter of educating and getting people to be more, I hate to use the word sophisticated, because I don't think I ever want Leroy to become anything more than what he is right now, because he's a treasure. I know, I love the guy. My point is, there's a problem here, and otherwise we wouldn't be sitting here talking about it. And I just hope you guys, and Representative Kitts has already volunteered with the chair's indulgence to lead some kind of workforce or work group. Sit down and talk to these folks, try and figure this out. That's what I'd like to see happen, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Chalmers. Representative Kitts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As one of those fellow sophisticants, I just for correction, Mr. Sherman, I don't think anybody suggested simply that it was a handshake. I think that was my testimony. So I'd appreciate it if you didn't try to use it against me in committee. Appreciate it.
Certainly.
Any other comments? Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3080. And for those that were here to testify on House Bill 3026 or 2949, there will be another day. And with that, okay, it was, 3236, there will be another day. Okay, with that, we are adjourned.
Okay.